I am excited to be here with Dipti Desai, the founder and CEO of Krystal. Welcome to the Watson Weekly.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. We didn't meet for a long time. I think you reached out based on something. I picked up Krystal when they initially, I think you guys raised your seed round. Was that right?
That's correct.
Tell your story about how you found out about me and how we initially met, and I think it has to deal with NDR, Nicholas David Richards. So,
Rick, you're a figure in the commerce space. So obviously heard of you a long time ago, and pretty much as soon as I started working in this space. So that was now almost 4 or 5 years ago.
yeah.
Just really liked your content and all the work that you were doing, and particularly because you started out as an electrical engineer in your
Yeah.
career, like I did, and then found your way to commerce. So that was definitely very interesting, a good coincidence. But no, really, I mean, I love sort of the approach you took at the content. It's very thoughtful, very methodical. It's the real deal as I see it. So I really enjoyed that. And then at some point, I just reached out to you to say, hey, I love learning from other people. And I think that's how we first connected in the digital world. I think it might have still been in the thick of the pandemic, so I don't think folks were moving around as much yet. And then to your point, I think fast forward, I believe it was Shop Talk. Shop Talk. I think a couple of years ago, 2023, that
Yeah.
I was hanging out with NDR, and I think we ran into you, and that's the first time in person. So
Yeah.
that's my recollection anyway. So.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I think seeing I think one of the things that shocked me, so I try to track as many as possible, and I think it's impossible to track them all for the podcast, just what's happening in fundraising so I can just understand where the space is going and kind of new startups that are going on. And a startup that it was dedicated to EDI was like whoa, like who's the there's got to be the nerdiest person I've ever met. And I count myself in that group because we're both electrical engineers, and so I think we're maybe kindred spirits that way. And so almost I think it would be good to start from your how did you get there? It's like you said, you've been in the space for 5 years. But I think we probably need to back up from that even.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the somewhat short version of the story is I really loved physics growing up. And so found my way into electrical engineering as a result. And then right out of school, got my first job in Silicon Valley, cutting my teeth as a hardware engineer. And I probably don't think I quite realized at the time what a big deal and an opportunity it was for me. And this was, I'm dating myself, but this was just before the first smartphone came out. So it was, on the one hand, it was a dry time in the semiconductor business, just before the first iPhone, et cetera, came out. But it was also, we knew we were on the cusp of something exciting because there was just a lot of things trending in that direction. So that's really how I got my start. And then really before starting Krystal, spent the entirety of my career in Silicon Valley and Bay Area at startups of all sizes. And what happened is, in a way, as a result of the first iPhone launching, sorry, I should say iPhone, not just smartphone. As a result of the first iPhone launching in 2007, by the time the 2010s rolled around, it had become very apparent to everybody in the technology business that data was coming at us faster and in bigger, dense volumes than they ever had before. And a lot of the databases and applications, et cetera, that existed were just no longer cutting it, right? Because they were just built for another time. And so sort of as that, big data is not a term really anyone talks about anymore these days, but it was certainly very, very hot in 2010 plus minus, and really the for a good chunk of that decade. Anyway, so I found my way then into startups that were working on a variety of applications and in different ways, but it was all around data, right? And I think my engineering background sort of served me well, but really it was a lot of just learning on the job. But that's really how I spent a long time you know, building and really learning from people who knew how to build data products, scaling that, scaling teams around things like that. And then I think that sort of gave me hopefully a good foundation for, you know, starting Crystal and kind of where we're at and where we're going.
Yeah. And so going from data into something, I mean, EDI is it's an arcane thing. There's certain structure to it. It has, did it like really resonate with your sort of like component-based spec sheet mind where you're like trying to wire up a circuit board and now you just have a spec of these certain documents that have to fire at different times?
Yeah, that's actually, it's funny you say it that way. I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but actually it's very good, right? I mean, the early part of my career, I was exactly doing that, which is spending a lot of time in lab and, you know, with the hardware equipment and producing spec sheets and, you know, very structured output of that sort, right? So yeah, it definitely bears some resemblance. But yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, I sort of just really looked at it as a data problem versus getting too caught up in, you know, sort of its age and, you know, things like that. What I had to get to your point, though, what I had to gain conviction around, obviously, is that what was it and what is it going to be relevant in the next 5, 10, 20 years? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, just pragmatically, it wouldn't make sense for me to spend my time building in that area, right?
Yeah.
And I think we'll probably talk more about this as, you know, as this evolves. But that's really sort of what I sort of, that was kind of the perspective I came out with, is that really this is a data language. It's not a technology. It's not a protocol. It shares a lot in common, I think, with the English language, which is obviously very old at this point. It's been through its own evolution, things like that, or like SMTP and POP3 in the context of email, which obviously has also now been around for decades and decades. So that was sort of the perspective that I emerged.
Again, it kind of developed not out of the like IP and TCP IP stacks. It developed like concurrently in some respects. So it was just different things. Well, maybe we should bring the audience along. What the hell is EDI?
Yeah, EDI stands for Electronic Data Interchange. And you can think of it as a set of rules or a business language that allows two or more businesses to exchange information with each other. Mm. Right?
And the exchange of information, data is about communication, particularly when we're talking about machines that are talking to each other ultimately. Who's on each side and what's the point of the communication generally?
Yeah. I mean, if we sort of talk about the retail and commerce world, right, it is buyers and suppliers, for example, logistics providers, right, transportation companies. So there's multiple parties like that, but sort of a canonical example is buyers and sellers looking to exchange information with each other.
Yeah, so you're a merchandiser at Walmart and you have a big supplier that's in 2,400 stores, you know, and you need a reliable way to communicate inventory stock information, order information, delivery to the stores, all of these things.
Invoicing, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Makes sense. And so you had this moment, so getting into Crystal a little bit, you had this moment where you knew the data systems that were in place in the past didn't quite match. I guess, was there an aha moment for Crystal for you? Like something needs to be, now we're in the retail and e-commerce setting. This is the type of communication that actually needs to be improved, changed, revolutionized, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was around 2021, right, when COVID was in full swing and, you know, most of us were still sort of, you know, working from home and, you know, so on and so forth. What was also happening is pure sort of e-commerce, et cetera, was taking off, right? Mm-hmm. And I, at the time, was helping out, you know, this nonprofit along with other volunteers just to help solve the PPE shortage problem in the country. Mm. And there wasn't really a big plan there, really, because I mean, I had just, you know, come off of a very
just a small project solving the PPE issue for the entire country.
I mean, it was, I mean, all credit goes to sort of the folks that really started that nonprofit, and you know, some of us were helping hands there, so won't take too much credit for it, but definitely got to play a small role. What was simultaneously happening is as I was talking to a lot of different brands and manufacturers, just by virtue of, you know, doing this work, they started to tell me, and this is actually, you know, we talk a little bit more about it these days, but NeuroGum, you know, which is blowing up everywhere, and it's so exciting to see that progress. They were our first customer. They were our first, you know, willing design partner. And folks like them and others who really were on the cutting edge of represented a lot of the like macro shifts and the zeitgeist of, you know, millennials becoming decision makers and Gen Z sort of starting to enter the workforce, right, which sort of started to happen around this same time. They were sort of telling me that we don't think that when the world reopens, like old will be new again, right? They were very convinced about that, which is things will go omni-channel versus just direct. Right. And really, I had to, you know, in addition to sort of gaining conviction around EDI and its relevance and, you know, and so on and so forth, is obviously nobody knows, right? Everyone is hypothesizing. And I had to basically, I went back to sort of looking at the numbers and the data and how things were shifting and why might that be true if it were to be true. And this is still 2021. So really no one knew because things weren't reopening and so on and so forth just yet. But as I dug into the numbers and knew that I was talking to people that really were on the forefront and the cutting edge of what they were doing, you know, I think I developed very strong conviction that indeed when the world reopens, old will be new again, right? The millennials and the Gen Zs are already unhappy and have a high bar for the experiences they expect in the workplace now with the tools they're using and things like that. And layered on with my own experiences and so on and so forth. And by end of 2021, I had developed research. This needed to happen.
In terms of your customers, the problem that they have when they come to you, you're kind of hinting at it, that there are these omni problems. How do they describe it in their language, the problem that they're trying to solve?
Yeah, I mean, from their perspective, this is, you know, one lens of it is that it's a revenue diversification, business diversification problem, right? So to the extent that they are looking for new customers and, you know, margin profiles and, you know, expand kind of distribution channels, they're really looking at this as a foundation and an infrastructure that powers sort of that revenue diversification channel and business diversification, right? And then it is a it's an infrastructure and an enablement layer that makes that possible.
Got it. And who is your ideal customer? I guess in that vein, revenue diversification for somebody who is a direct brand, sort of a traditional, if there's anything like a traditional direct consumer brand these days, because it's a relatively new in the world, it sounds like they're generally coming from a more digitally native scenario and then opening up in their own retail stores, or more likely in this scenario, wholesale through, you know, big chains, big and small.
Yeah, exactly. And that's certainly, you know, where that's certainly where we started and you know, continue to focus on. And as that network that we build, the digital network that we continue to build to connect different entities, buyers and suppliers, but also sort of the stakeholders around that. We're also finding that we power, you know, buyers that work with their suppliers, right? And so they could be a manufacturer working with scores or more of their own suppliers.
Got it.
It's actually the same concept.
Sort of like up, sort of like upstream in their supply chain. That's fascinating because they have an assembly problem and they have, you know, ostensibly retail oriented problems.
Yeah, they're procuring too, right?
So. Right, exactly. No, that makes sense. And how do you charge your customers at a high level? Obviously, you don't need to talk specifically about Raycard or anything like that, but what's your business model based on?
Yeah, I mean, as a digital network, really, we are in the business of connecting. And so therefore, we primarily charge based on connections and, of course, a setup fee, right, which includes testing and onboarding, because that ends up being pretty focused on the individual customer's needs and business model. So those are some of the primary avenues.
Got it. No, I mean, that makes sense. And look, we're talking about a technology that I think most people have never heard of, unless you've been, I would say, in retail, because we're all in retail, but like asked by a large retailer to connect to them because they told you to do so. Otherwise, you might never have to think about it ever.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What is it about EDI that makes it so dominant and irreplaceable, almost like the cockroach that's never going to leave us or something?
I think what EDI provides, right, is basically structure and rules, right? And that's why I liken it to the English language. So let me make a distinction. And oh, by the way, I'd love to take this opportunity to tell anyone who will listen that EDI is not a technology, it's a protocol, right? So let me see if this the English language analogy works, because sometimes people tell me they really like it, but let's see if it works here. So what the English language does for us is, for one, it standardizes, right? You and I can speak to each other, versus if you and I spoke wholly different languages that had different rules and we were plopped into this podcast, I think even in the age of AI, we would have
Some challenges.
Yeah, some challenges just connecting, communicating, right? Things like that. So that is one side of it. So English language, therefore, now provides these rules. So for example, if I have to say, hey, Rick, how are you? There is a certain structure to that sentence, to that question, right?
Right.
Now, if I were to instead come and say, hey, Rick, how you are, you probably wouldn't correct me or, you know, maybe judge me even, but you would know that that is not correct. Why? Because the language has rules, right?
Yeah.
And based on those rules is really how we're able to connect and communicate, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that sentence structure and the rules of the language don't dictate at all is how I'm asking you how you are, right? So I would construct that question, and then I have to decide, am I going to text Rick that question? Am I going to email Rick that question? Am I going to handwrite a letter asking Rick that question? So the structure and the rules are independent of the connectivity mechanism, right? And that's exactly what I kind of found about EDI, which is, and this is where I think there's a lot of confusion on, like, well, API is sort of this, you know, in kind of the next gen, like, is EDI the predecessor to API? And those are apples and oranges, right? Because EDI helps me understand how I should construct a question or the sentence, right? How are you? The API equivalent is what tells me, am I needing to send this via a handwritten letter, or a text message, an email, or whatever the message of communication might be. And so that's why it's not either or. It's
Yeah. And so I think knowing that it can help these, you know, retailers and their suppliers communicate better, agree to a common set of rules, certainly help facilitate connectivity. And obviously people come to you because it's not simple. Or maybe they've overlooked something, or they thought they could do it themselves. I mean, the best situation for any startup is like someone who's trying to actively pay money to solve the problem now. And they're like, I give up. I can't do it myself. Like, please, I need to buy some technology, software as a service, whatever it is, to get it done. Like, what do you do? Leaders miss something about this kind of protocol and connectivity that that you think would be beneficial for others to know?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I think one thing, therefore, to now expand on the relevance of the protocol and, you know, so on and so forth, I think it's really important for leaders to understand and invest in. So I'll break this down into what is kind of relevant and important, perhaps from a customer-based perspective, and then just more generally in the ecosystem, right? If you're generally in the ecosystem, I think it's really important to understand and separate out the application layer capabilities and the modernization of that versus really the protocol and what it on that it sits. So what I mean by that is a lot of companies today leverage EDI, but they also have application layers on top of it that are really aged. And that's really is their Achilles heel versus kind of the protocol. What I mean by that is things like visibility. Hey, I sent this brand a purchase order. Did it leave your systems? Do you have the visibility? Do you have the alerting, the logging, the monitoring, the anomaly detection, the intelligence to know that proactively? That is independent of EDI. That is much more at the application layer, right? And that's where a lot of the digital transformation and evolution should be focused. And I think there's a lot of conversation, however, on the underlying protocol, right? So kind of to use the email example, you know, Gmail came along and solved a lot of the problems. You know, Gmail's, you know, a couple of decades old at this point, but it came and solved a lot of problems that Yahoo Mail had, as an example, right? I mean, I'm speaking as a former Yahoo Mail user, there used to be all this spam and space and, you know, used to be a problem. And there was no ecosystem where you could connect your Yahoo Mail to your CRM and the interoperability that came with that, right? The underlying protocol didn't really change as much, right? But what Gmail did better is catch spam better. Well, presumably they just have better algorithms. They solved the space problem, right? There's a bunch of good engineering challenges there. They built an ecosystem around Gmail. So today we can connect that to our CRM and do work where we need to do the work without leaving the tool and, you know, those kinds of things. So that's kind of the difference between separating out what's possible, and particularly around the age of AI. There is just, I mean, every day we add so many things to our roadmap, and God knows we're not going to get to all of those things, but it is so much of that is possible. And that's what we need to be, I think, as an ecosystem, be focusing on those possibilities versus the underlying protocols.
Yeah. And so this trading partner, there's sort of like one element to it, which is sort of trading partner communication. The other part of it is, it's just the rhythm of retail. Like, you have a new system of processes that come out. Like, how was a SKU born in your system? When, at what point in its life cycle do you communicate to your trading partners?
That's right.
How do you know it's ready? And so I guess, where does Crystal, I think this is super helpful because it also helps me frame a few next questions. Like, where does Crystal start and stop in the life cycle of the brand and the retailer?
Yeah, for sure. So we are, you know, focused so much of our origin story is with a focus on brands and suppliers. Mm-hmm. So in that context, we are very focused on the order that they receive from their customer, and then the workflow that naturally triggers downstream, right? So to kind of use your Walmart example, if you're a supplier receiving an order from Walmart, that just kicks off kind of a natural series of steps around the acknowledgements, you know, on the ASN, the advanced notice, the invoice, and other sort of related exchange of information, right? And transaction. So that's sort of one side of it. The natural extension to that, yet again, from a brand and supplier perspective, is the scaling of their financial and operational discipline, right? So this is where they want to automate as much as possible the fulfillment process for B2B. Likewise, accountants, et cetera, get involved in terms of, you know, when can invoices be sent and kind of that interplay and dependence between finance and operations, right? Mm-hmm. Another big part of Crystal is enabling that integrations network, which allows them to scale and automate their financial and supply chain operations.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of people involved in this process, including the merchants, you know, the purchasing teams, or, you know, potentially a sales rep, the finance team who is just trying to track what the hell's going on. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously the warehouse. Mm-hmm. Like, the product is sitting somewhere on a pallet or a case pack or like whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it needs to go out and it needs to match some kind of standard on top of, you know, it has to, you have to send it at the right time so that on the other end, there's a physical thing. This is not just a data exchange for the purposes of displaying other data. This actually represents something physical happening too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that it is a very sort of mission critical. And that's why we take our role very seriously in that, right? Mm-hmm. We all, so as an example, to your point, when we were rolling out kind of that very first version of the product, and I think all products, like at the business level, at the product level, should have a singular metric that they're focusing on mm-hmm. at a point in time. And reliability was our singular KPI, right? Mm-hmm. It was not how, of course, the UX had to look pleasing and the product had to be easy to use and things like that. But that was not even our key focus. It was singularly just reliability. No document could get lost, coming or going. End of story, period, right? And that was very much what we were focused on. So absolutely, to your point, like we're a mission critical infrastructure product. And, you know, much like Shopify on the direct to consumer side, a lot of that is what we're enabling on the B2B side of the house as well.
Got it. And do you think, I mean, you've talked with a lot of customers and a lot of customers understand, maybe they have a connectivity solution they've used in the past. Do you think most customers understand what their problems are, or they kind of don't know what they don't know?
It's a great question. I think the short answer, the short version of the answer is it depends on the customer, right? There are some customers who really have invested in operational excellence and so on from the very beginning. And they certainly do. And then there are some companies who are, you know, 1, 2, 3 person teams. And now, to be clear, the size of the team and their operational excellence or level of operational discipline isn't necessarily correlated.
Yep.
That said, if they had their origins in sort of, right, building this physical product first and bringing it to market and then expanding distribution, sometimes they are finding themselves playing catch up on the operational excellence department. So it definitely depends on the size of the business, the product category, the maturity of the organization itself.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that, you know, I talk to different types of software solutions. I'm going to use one example, Avalara, and it's just not related to what you're doing, but tax, like no one buys tax software because they love tax software, right? They buy it because they were audited or they, you know what I mean? They got a fine. And then all of a sudden they hire an accountant who comes, looks, and you're like, whoa, you have like, not only do you have this one problem, you have these 5 to 10 problems. Do you find that with EDI? Like, let's say they're on a current provider, maybe their retailer is penalizing them. Because that's something else maybe you can explain to the audience a little bit for like bad EDI has a cost, like a hard cost.
Yeah.
To the supplier. And so I would love you to unpack that. But then also, is that involved in how you talk to brands about like, okay, you're getting these fines, but actually the problem could be worse. And do you help them understand that?
In terms of, to your point, in terms of why suppliers find themselves getting a solution like what Crystal is building and enabling in the first place, is so that they can do business with said customer, said buyer, right? Now, there's a few things. And really, when you sort of think about it, the very base level, I always, whenever there's a solution presented, I always think of it in the context of alternatives available or possible, right? In these cases, the alternatives are you will be receiving your POs via email, and then a lot of that back and forth exchange happens on PDFs and emails.
Right.
Put yourself in the shoes of the buyer who really is in a strategic role versus, right, in an operational kind of, you know, role. That gets untenable very quickly when they're working with hundreds of suppliers and certainly combined across buyers, thousands of suppliers, right? So there's just a necessity to streamline all that as overused as that word is. That really is a need to streamline and scale all of that because it is not humanly possible to communicate in this example for a buyer to communicate with tons of suppliers via email like this, right? That's really been the alternative. Now, when they do digitize and start using a software like this, there's also other things, right? There's, you know, penalty, right? And you will definitely have buyers who will say whether they're a retailer, distributor, et cetera, is, hey, maybe the first 90 days of the relationship, you don't need to be on EDI, but after that, right? And sometimes we also see that they get more, the suppliers get more favorable net terms in terms of invoicing and, you know, payouts and things like that when they're on EDI. On the cost side, to your point, there is a penalty, right? If they didn't get on the software after a certain number of days or a certain number of months. But then, of course, even during kind of the pick, pack, ship process, right? You know, there is vendor compliance and kind of a world unto itself. And then those costs are also very, very real, to your point, right? I mean, again, data shows could be easily 10% of the PO value, right, for not complying with those different rules. And so, yeah, so the cost is very real. It's very P&L impacting either way you slice it. And so it really kind of helps streamline, scale, all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I must be honest. I used to geek out on retailer supplier handbooks and just how freaking complicated those things are. I mean, sometimes there are hundreds of pages of requirements for the brand who's your customer. And now, like, how is it even possible that you can do all those things as a small company?
Yeah, I know you're right. And that is why we take our mission very seriously, right? Because we enable them. We study those books so they don't have to. We turn those books into software and workflow platform so they don't have to. And by the way, this is much in the same way that we use other software to build our, not just our products, but even just the company and the business, right? So for instance, if we're using a software for feature flag or a software to help us scale support, we too are using somebody else's product to help scale our own business, right? And so we see that role, we see ourselves playing that role in other businesses. And for the same reason, we take that role very seriously. And could we build a feature flag software or another software just on the basis of technical merit alone? We could, but should we? Probably not, right? And so that's why we end up paying for that software. And so in the same way, why we come to exist for our customers.
Got it. You mentioned that, you know, a lot of the problems that people attribute to EDI is not really based on EDI. It's based on these like 20-year-old merchandising or operate financial systems that haven't adapted. Maybe they aren't as flexible. Where does, you know, especially given your North Star is, you know, has been reliability, where does this sort of supplier communication need to go next? Like, what's the next level? Is it up the application stack or is it actually into adjacencies? Or like, how do you see that evolving?
Yeah, I mean, it's also a great question, just kind of given the rate at which all of these layers are both getting innovated on, but also disrupted, right? Both of those are happening. So some of that is just happening through straight up replacement and disruption, and some of it is happening as a kind of a more gradual kind of evolving to the next step.
Yeah.
I think the key things that any business really should care about and are caring about, and therefore any solution, whether it's at the application layer, one level above it, or adjacent to it, I think it all starts by focusing on very much weaving in intelligence, connectivity, right? And simplicity in all that they do. I think that is really the guiding principle.
Got it. Give me an example of intelligence. I think that's an interesting thread I'll pull up.
Yeah. I mean, intelligence could be, right? Like the example we quickly touched on before is sometimes our customers can't have confidence that if their buyer is telling them that a PO was sent out, that it was indeed sent out, right? And so now what it is lacking in is a basic level of intelligence on knowing did it go out? And if it hit a roadblock, where in that quote unquote supply chain of that data movement might an issue have occurred, right? Yeah. That's probably a very basic, but a very significant example of like where we see the intelligence sort of, you know, standard that is out there truly lagging 20 years at this point. And that's a pretty easy one, I think, to get caught up on, right? And it will make such a difference for so many stakeholders. But that's just one example.
Got it. And as far as that intelligence, I would love to like do a little bit of a day in the life of a brand for you, which is, you know, you're on Shopify or SaaS commerce. A lot of people are on Shopify, clearly, in the audience and everywhere. And they suddenly realize they need this thing to connect with new trading partners, whether it's retail stores or other people like that, distributors, as you mentioned, in kind of a B2B setting. What is there? You mentioned, you kind of hinted at it earlier, the alternative is email. And there was like, I can't do this anymore. And so you mentioned like there might be like an onboarding period where like, yeah, you're a supplier, but you're not a key supplier.
Mm.
And maybe you don't have enough volume to justify the work or the software and they're like, whatever. But like, walk me through at what point it makes sense for someone to have software at all. And then what does their life look like after they have it?
Yeah. To address the first part of your question, it makes sense when it makes sense in the context of the customer, in this example, the retailer or the distributor you're doing business with, right? Because even if a supplier works with, call it a half a dozen retailers, mm-hmm. all those relationships may not be equally at the same stage, at the same maturity level, at the same volumes, et cetera. So that's one consideration. The other consideration is they will tell you, right? If the retailer decides that even at the lower volumes, you must get on board, right. that right. there isn't really a whole lot of choice. And so that's
right.
their consideration is if they're telling you, sure, you should do it, you ought to do it. So it's sort of, there isn't like a, you know, cookie cutter answer there, but certainly those are some factors to consider. And not to mention, you know, cost of labor, cost of mistakes, right, cost of, you know, sort of, again, the things that almost feel too cliched, but until mm-hmm. you have run into those problems in the real world and in real life, you don't appreciate it and then don't make those investments too late. But that's sort of the other consideration is your, and then also what kind of scale you foresee your business getting, right? Because maybe today the volumes may not be small, but if all indicators are leading to this scaling, then you are much, you know, better off making those investments today when the volumes are still picking up, right? So that's sort of the first part of it. The second part of it is when you are on the software, once you've decided to get the software, then, I mean, essentially there's an onboarding period, right? Where a lot of your, you know, products are getting set up. In this case, you know, your account with Crystal is getting set up and some basic information about your, as in the supplier relationship with that retailer are being kind of clarified and set up and things like that, right? So there's that onboarding period. And then really once that is in place, you start getting your live orders. Then again, you know, depending on which customer, i.e. retailer or buyer in this example you're working with, that will dictate, right, the minutia of do they need an acknowledgement or not, or ASNs? If so, how should those be defined? And mm-hmm. you know, how that informs the pick pack process and then on the invoicing side and so on. So that's at a you know, high level. And then of course, as the business is scaling, or if we, you know, are working with customers that are already at scale and have migrated to us, then it's about connectivity, kind of that last mile, if you will, connectivity with their ERP, with their WMSs, right, to keep that business humming along. So those are broad strokes, kind of what that looks like from their perspective.
Got it. And I mean, obviously you've been on a journey from, I guess, initially you mentioned Miragum and, you know, some of the smaller brands you started with. I guess at what point working with some of those customers did you sort of think to yourself, it's like, wow, we're actually helping these folks?
Yeah. I think that was, I think that feeling has been, luckily for us, and particularly as, you know, we're very mission oriented, I think that was important to find that and feel that before we wrote a single line of code, right? If we did this, do we find it making an impact in the lives of people for whom we're building it, right? Because there were other ideas, et cetera, that we tested that didn't have that same level of pull or fulfillment, right? And so on the one hand, like that feeling was necessary almost as a prerequisite for us to even begin doing it. But to your point, I still remember it was actually right about now, 3 years ago, just before the July 4th holidays in 2022, is when the first purchase order ever landed for one of our customers. And Rick, we felt like we had landed on the moon, like, right? Like collectively, we had just like, I mean, that feeling is still so palpable 3 years on, because we saw the difference it made in their lives. We saw what that meant to them. And there
was no longer July 4th. It's like 8:50 day to you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's right. So you know, and so when that first kind of, you know, PO hit and all that activated, if you will, downstream for them, downstream for us, is when we felt like, my gosh, this is so real. This is so important. And, you know, we therefore kind of that order became the very much kind of the unifying force, if you will, for our team, because everyone that landed, we knew, you know, was like a little, you know, landing on the moon, if you will, for them, right? Because it is very important, and then by extension for us. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that's a fascinating story. I would love to like hate on AI for a second, not because I think AI is a bad idea, but also because I think it goes back to the point you made about language and communication. The things that EDI communicates, and I think that especially high volume trading partners communicate to each other, they have to be very precise. By definition, they have to be very reliable, because ultimately an accountant is going to come by and making sure that everything that was ordered is paid for and delivered and in the bank account at the same time. So the, like, you know, golden three-way match that people talk about between like parcels and money and merchandise. But this thing that everyone is exciting about, including myself, it's humans are so imprecise in everything we freaking talk about. Like if you and I were to say like, hey, I would love 800, you know, 800 of those things that we talked about last week, you know, your purchasing system be like, what? What do you talk about? Like when does it need to be delivered? Oh, to my East Coast warehouse. Like, oh, actually I want it to Florida, or it needs to be, what is it? There's a precision to me, it kind of feels to me, that can't be even communicated in other languages and formats, or it would be like incredibly verbose.
Yeah.
And there's something about the economy of the communication between almost like a purpose designed language for trading.
Yeah.
Which is one of the ways I think about kind of EDI a little bit. Like how do you, I mean, clearly there are tons of uses of EDI on top of what's going on in the trading network, but in the trading network itself, it just seems like it would get in the way.
Yeah. It's, and this is sort of the, I think I completely agree. This is the magic. I mean, you know, of the right tool for the right job, right? I'm a big believer in that. And we are, I think we are so lucky in terms of having this playground where we have EDI and API and AI and all these things. And I think our job on the behalf of the customer and the broader ecosystem is to be very thoughtful on when we leverage what, right? Because exactly to your point, with EDI, with dollars and cents from an accounting department's perspective, it can't be probabilistic. It's got to be deterministic, right? So in that sense, EDI almost acts like blockchain, right? Because it is almost indisputable that this right? And so, and that is very powerful, and we should lean into that where it makes sense and everywhere it makes sense. At the same time, for, you know, certain interactions like, hey, how much, you know, did I sell last week? AI is great for that, right? Because it can exactly tell you the because all of these things have to be, I think, tied back to the so what or the cost of being wrong, right? The cost of being right, yes, but the cost of being wrong, particularly again, when love the sort of the three-way match that you described, right? Because that match doesn't happen until it's kind of the last decimal is exactly so, right?
Right.
And so, so really knowing where and for what use cases is EDI relevant? For what use cases is API relevant? For what use cases AI relevant? And really anything else? And how do you blend those things? And so that from the customer's perspective, it is almost indistinguishable when one came and the other didn't, right? Because they care so much about their workflows, their business process, their business objectives. And our job is to kind of be thoughtful about when to use what and the blend of those different things.
I've been using this phrase, like, each generation, 5-7 years, there's a new big thing. 4 years ago, it was like Web3 blockchain. You hit on it. That's another one where it's like, unless you really, really need it in a specific domain, like, most people don't need it. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to, it's a database. It's an expensive database. Most databases don't need it. We've had databases forever. So in kind of similar here, sure, software is eating the world, but it's not going to, everything about AI, just because a venture capitalist raised their fund all focused on AI doesn't mean it's going to replace everything. It just means that's where their growth is coming from. And so this idea that there are going to be different types of solutions that live alongside each other, I think, is something, especially for the larger operators, that that's just going to be their life.
Well, sir,
it's I think it's pretty fascinating. The one thing I wanted to hit on before we go is like where Crystal could go, because it's clearly, there's this communication layer, but you go across so many different departments. I think almost think about like workflow through a business. Like, what is the day in the life of the merchant, like the merchandising team, marketing, which we haven't really touched on at all, operations, warehouse, finance. What do you think of, like, if you had to prioritize sort of like, we're really going to become, I'm just going to do something crazy like this warehouse connectivity company, because that's really where the data breakdowns are. If you follow like your original vision of like, the data isn't right, we need to fix the data before we do anything else.
I mean, I you know, one of the, what AI has, you know, shown, just to sort of go back to your previous point a little bit, is it has, right? I mean, so much of sort of the SaaS applications felt like a layer on a database. Right? And that was sort of a good chunk of, not to sort of reduce any of the, you know, there's obviously been behemoths and very large companies built on that premise. And these things are always more complex than meet the eye. From a very, you know, far distance, it may just look like a layer on top of a database, but clearly there's a lot more happening there. Workflows, business logic, buy-in within organizations, workflow dependencies on those products, right? There's a lot there. What is super interesting and exciting for us at Crystal, I think, in the age of AI, is the prominence, the relevance, and the rise of SaaS networks, right? Because what that is, and you hit the nail exactly on the head, is we may start by enabling the brand to receive that order from a buyer. But look what starts to quickly happen. the buyer, you know, the brand is there. There's a variety of brand operators, the salesperson, the accountant, the warehouse. And I think for the first time in a long time, this concept of SaaS networks, I mean, when I would try to explain to folks outside of the ecosystem what we're building, I think the concept of that there's a SaaS product built for that needs to be built for so many different stakeholders around a workflow was still relatively new, believe it or not, right? Mm-hmm. But with AI, what it has done is it has sort of cleared the hurdle of, I think we all agree that a layer on a database is no longer cut it, right? Like that sort of type of business gets democratized. Everyone can build that for themselves almost in some ways. But what becomes much more interesting and complex and valuable to power are these networks where work is getting in the context of business, right? So we are incredibly excited for being kind of almost that first company which sort of put that network view, enabled a cross-functional team. And we always tell our customers that part of the reason we don't charge based on per user is because it is a team sport and we don't handicap a team, right? And I know from my own and everybody's user, we know we're going to share passwords and do all that. And it's like, why do that? Like, enable the team, go empower them, right? And there's so much here to bring to life. And so with Crystal, I mean, we're super excited to sort of play a role in becoming one of the standards of B2B commerce, right? Much like became a standard. And of course, Webex and these companies existed prior to that, but they clearly have become standard, or Slack has become a standard, or Figma has become a standard, right? All these companies haven't done that. And, you know, what are any of these companies really even doing is they're enabling networks of people, right? In their own ways. And we're super excited to be in that same vein, be enabling this network of group of people that come around to solve a business problem. And I am super excited to see how we, you know, continue along that journey.
Yeah, I'm getting excited just listening to it. So I know that you must feel it within you, your customers, your team. And so I've really enjoyed this conversation, Dipti. You want to remind the audience about your name. It's a unique name, crstl.ai. Why the name?
Yeah, great question. Get that. So in the very early days when I was just helping when I was helping out at the nonprofit, and kind of brands started to come to me and say, hey, you have a data background and I have these data questions, like, can you help me understand XYZ? I just needed a placeholder project name, right? Like, literally, it's like if I'm kicking off a Google slide and I'm staring at an empty deck being like, what am I even doing? Like, this project needs a name. And, you know, it was very much around kind of the themes of connectivity and transparency. And there's something very long lasting about Crystal and sort of that network, you know, that we talk about. And so it sort of became kind of just placeholder name. And at the time, I used to just spell it normally, right? Because there was no company. There was, you know, really just nothing. I just needed a project name. So it was really Project Crystal at the time. And once it sort of felt like maybe we were onto something, maybe there's a company there potentially. I kid you not, I went to bed one day and I woke up and said to myself, I don't want, and this may not be rational at all, but for some reason, this was a very strong feeling what entered. And I didn't want to have cry in the name of a company. Right, right. Because I was like, God knows we'll be crying. Like, this stuff is hard. Like,
yeah, it's cry style.
Yeah, that's going to be part of the journey, but certainly don't want that in the name. And so, then did a quick kind of domain check. And even then, not very much luck on that front. And it was more certain that, you know, didn't want to have cry in the name. And also really what Crystal stood for, which is, like I said, sort of this aspect of connectivity, longevity, robustness, transparency, and all of those attributes really appealed. And then there was just some practical considerations around, domain name and, you know, the spellings and, you know, things like that. And that sort of led to the name.
Awesome. I mean, well, I'm happy to have shared this time with you, hear your personal story, our shared journey from electrical engineering to e-commerce. And so looking forward, appreciate this partnership and looking forward to seeing big things from Crystal in the future.
Yeah. Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure to chat. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much.